Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price. I'm here with Chad Bird. We got the Bibles open to Exodus. Chad, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. I'm good. Had a good week and ready to dive back in. I think we left poor baby Moses in the middle of the river last week.
We did.
He's been waiting on us.
Yeah, we better check in on him. We were going to spend this whole show talking about the presidential election, and then we decided that, well, since we left Moses in a precarious situation, we'll just do that.
Yeah, I think everyone can be happy to have a little break from politics.
There you go.
Flooded with it for several months. So a very non-political subject is where we're gonna be starting today. I think we left off a few verses into chapter 2. Is that what you remember, Dan?
Yep, I believe so.
All right. So just kind of recap what's happened so far. We have the reference made to Moses' parents, that they're from the house of Levi. His mom gets pregnant with him, and she has him. But, of course, he's born into a dangerous situation because he's living under this decree of Pharaoh that every male Israelite child is to be cast into the Nile River. So what does his mom do? Well, she hides him as long as she can for the first 3 months of his life, but he's getting too big to hide, or the situation is getting too dangerous for him to be hidden any longer. Whatever it is, after the 3 months, she comes up with this plan. She makes a little ark. We talked about that last time, that this is one of only two stories in the Bible where this Hebrew noun is used for ark. Of course, the ark of Noah, and now we have the ark of Moses. These ships of salvation, if you want to call them that, that are located in waters that are filled full of danger and death, and yet in both cases, God preserves the ones inside the ark alive. He preserved Noah and his family, and now he's going to preserve Moses as well, but in a most unexpected way. So we have the ark. We have baby Moses in the ark. The ark is covered with tar and pitch, just like the big ark of Noah was. She carries this down to the Nile River, and I guess, you know, if I were a lawyer, I suppose that maybe I could make a case that she actually maybe didn't follow the letter of the law, but she did follow the spirit of the law, because the decree of Pharaoh was that every male Israelite was to be thrown into the Nile River. And his mother does put Moses into the Nile River. She doesn't throw him in there. It's a much softer verb that's used. She set him, or set it, the ark, among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. So she does put her baby in the Nile River, but safely ensconced within this little ark. So that's kind of where we left off last time, and we'll see what happens next. So we're now going to meet another person. Turns out that Moses has a sister. We're going to hear more about her as the story of Exodus unfolds. Right now, she is watching to see what's going to happen. You kind of get the feel as you go through this story that this was meticulously planned out. The ark was planned. The location where Moses was put into the river was planned. Miriam, the sister, she's watching from a distance, and she's going to speak here in just a few minutes. But that's where we are right now. Baby Moses in the river with his sister watching to find out what would happen. And now we're introduced to another person, to Pharaoh's daughter. This happens to be the spot where she comes down to bathe in the Nile River, and she's got her maidens, her maidservants, walking alongside the Nile. And all of a sudden, she sees the basket or the ark among the reeds, and she sends one of her maids to get it. and she brings it to her. And then it must have. I mean, this was well planned. This ark even had a little lid on it, evidently, because it says when she, that is Pharaoh's daughter, when she opened it, she looks inside, and lo and behold, there's a child, a boy. And here we have the beginning of what's going to be a radical change for Moses, because it says she had pity on him. So she didn't see this Israelite male child and think, oh, these are the ones that need to be thrown into the Nile River and then kill Moses. Instead, her initial reaction after the curiosity is pity. She has compassion on the child. And she recognizes, she says, this is one of the Hebrews' children. So we're kind of left, well, wondering now what's going to happen now. We've got the baby, we've got Pharaoh's daughter. I mean, she's part of the royal household, so if anybody should have been following the decree of Moses, it should have been Pharaoh. It should have been his daughter. So she's identified the Hebrew child. She has pity on him, and here is where the well thought out plan, if that's what it was, of Moses's mother comes into play. Because up walks Moses's sister, Miriam, and she says to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter is like, "Hey, yeah, that's a good idea. Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh, of course, Pharaoh's daughter doesn't know who this is, doesn't know that she's speaking to the very mother of this child that was found, and just a foundling to her, just an abandoned child. So she says, this just gets more ironic as it builds. She says, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. Now you talk about a situation that from the outside, from the very beginning, looks like it's going to end in a terrible tragedy. And in the end, ends up with a complete reversal of what we would expect, full of just unbelievable irony. Well, that's what we have here. We have a child that was destined for execution, basically. And instead of being killed, he saved. And not only was he saved, but he ends up being basically adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. And not only that, but he's placed back into the hands of his own mom. And then finally, on top of all of this, his own mother gets a paycheck from Pharaoh's daughter for nursing her own child. It's amazing.
It's pretty incredible. Because
Yeah.
you're not talking about she doesn't obey the law exactly, puts him in like the little basket here, sends him down. Still a pretty risky proposition, man.
Oh, yeah.
You're not like,
It's not
oh,
like
this will
this was
be this
foolproof at all.
you're not like this will be safe. No,
Yeah.
it's just better than like I mean like the chances go up, but like if somebody doesn't find him and do something, he's still gonna die in there.
Yeah.
Like, babies can't survive in baskets down rivers by themselves for very long. I know the whole thing is crazy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's one of the problems with actually knowing the biblical story, is you sort of get numb to some of these amazing details. But if you didn't know the story, you just heard it, and you didn't know how it was going to end up. You're just listening along, you know. You'd be like, oh man, this is bad. There's no way this is going to go well. You just put a baby in a little basket in the Nile River, he's going to die. The point is, you never would have expected this to be the outcome. Because from the very beginning, it looks like Amy has failure and death written all over it. And you get to the end, and I mean, things not only turn out good, I mean, they turn out phenomenal. You have a child from a slave caste who was supposed to be killed, who ends up being adopted as royalty. And his own mom is allowed then to spend some you know, formational time with him. We don't, of course, we're not told how long she nursed him, but the average age at which children were weaned back then was around, you know, 3 years old.
Yeah.
You talk about, we all know that the earliest years of a child's life are those which are most formational. So these early years of Moses' life are formed by his own family, even though he's been adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. He's formed those early years by the Hebrews.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. Yeah. If you're just reading this, like it's a book or something, it'd be pretty bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. Very bizarre. You know, there's an aspect to this too, that's worth mentioning in the broader perspective. And that is, this is a great example. Well, we've seen it already in chapters 1 and 2. We have great examples of how, God is using unexpected people to work good for Israel. People that are, you know, they're not powerful. They're certainly not famous. They're just kind of common everyday people. And not only that, but in a male and a patriarchal society such as this was, where men possess all of the positions of power and authority, you have God using women. You've got these Hebrew midwives in chapter 1 who are blatantly defying the order of Pharaoh to kill all the male offspring when they're being born. So they disobey Pharaoh, and they get away with it. And not only that, but God blesses them. So you have God using these two women in chapter 1. And then you have the same thing happening here. You have him using the mother of Moses and the sister of Moses, and even Pharaoh's daughter, even a pagan woman, to be instruments in his plan of saving Israel. So, and this is of course not isolated to just Exodus 1 and 2. Time and time again, whether it's a man or whether it's a woman, most of the people who end up being used by God to accomplish these important or saving deeds in the scriptures are not the people that we would have chosen. I mean, the only one I can think of that really, you know, when he's described, seems like, yeah, that dude would be a good choice, a good leader. I mean, electable, the guy that you would want really on your side. The only one that comes to mind really is Saul, the first king of Israel. He was a big guy. He towered above everybody, and yet look what happened to him. You know,
yeah,
he backfired.
Yes.
And then it ends up going to the runt of the litter, if you will, the eighth son of Jesse, David, who's just a kid. He ends up being the one who's the greatest king in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, everyone, by all accounts, yeah, Saul's the only guy that, like, it talks about, you know, from the moment he was sort of chosen, looking like, yeah, this is the guy right here. It says like he's a full head taller than everyone else, and yeah, he's just like this big dude. Yeah, that's pretty bizarre. I suppose you could say like Samson seems like a pretty legit guy, but Samson was crazy. So like.
Oh yeah, that dude was nuts. There's no doubt about it.
So probably not. They weren't like, yeah, like he's a good leader. They'd just be like, that guy's a freak.
Right. Yeah, a freak with a huge Achilles heel.
Yeah.
For women. So, yeah, I mean, you look. Well, the Book of Judges is a great example of this. You go through the Book of Judges and look at all these people that God used to deliver His people Israel, and every single one of them, you're shaking your head like, oh, no way, you know. God's HR department should all be fired because, you know, these are all bad decisions from an objective point of view, from a worldly perspective. They all look like they're just going to totally ruin whatever God has in mind. And yet they don't, you know, and that's the point. Like God is going to tell Moses in the next chapter when Moses says, "Hey, no, 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 I can't deliver Israel. There's no way." God says, "Look, I will be with you. That's it. I will be with you." In other words, whatever you do that's going to be good, I'm going to be the one doing it. So I'm going to, you know, squeeze myself into your person. And it will be me using you as my mask, my tool, in order to accomplish this. So God is always, as we frequently say in this podcast, God is always hiding himself behind his opposite. He's always putting himself in places and people and situations where you would least expect him, in order that it might be obvious that it's God who's doing it, that it's not human power or some kind of ingenuity or intellectual prowess or anything like that. It's always going to be God using the weakness of people to accomplish these acts of salvation for Israel as well as for us. And his use here of Pharaoh's daughter and of Moses' sister and Moses' mom and the Hebrew midwives is a great example of that. I guess you could say that with each of these situations of God working in these backwards, unexpected ways, you see the shadow of the cross. Because all of these, in one way or another, point toward that ultimate act of weak foolishness on God's part, submitting to death at the hands of sinners. And in that very death on the cross, then working the glorious act of salvation for the world. So, let's figure out what happened to Moses. I didn't mention this this last little bit here, ending this section. So Moses is placed with his mom. She gets a paycheck for nursing her child. And the child grows up, and his mom brings him to Pharaoh's daughter for sort of, I guess, an official adoption, as it were. And he became her son. That is the son of the princess. And she names him Moses, because I drew him out of the water, she says. So this is a play on a Hebrew verb, moshe, or masha, which means to pull out or to draw out. So she drew him, she pulled him out of the water, and so she gives him the name Moses. Now here's another, when you know the rest of the story, of course, this is another irony, because an Egyptian gives Moses his name, and that name is itself prophetic of what Moses will do for his own people, and at the same time do against the Egyptians, because he's going to draw his own people out of slavery in Egypt. He's going to lead them, draw them through the waters of the Red Sea, and those same waters will then collapse over the Egyptians. So already in his when he's a toddler, I suppose, and given the name Moses, that name is indicative of what he's going to grow up to be. So that's where we kind of wrap up his early life. And kind of like, I guess you can compare this to the life of Jesus. You know, we're not told a whole lot, and you guys are covering this, I'm sure, in 30 minutes in the New Testament. We're not told a whole lot about what happens in the early years of Jesus. Of course, we know a lot about his nativity, and then we meet him later when he's 12 years old in the temple. And then the Bible just, you know, skips way ahead until he actually begins his ministry. So the scriptures are never concerned with giving us a full life story of anybody. I mean, we probably know more about Moses than we do about almost anybody else. But even there, we're going to skip now from when he's just a toddler all the way till he's about 40 years old.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel between the narratives about Jesus and the narratives about Moses, is that they sort of do skip, like, yeah, he's a baby, here's how his birth happened. Here's how, you know, here's a couple of things about, you know, how his situation came about, where he got to where he grew up. But they don't really tell you about him growing up. So they do the same thing with Jesus, where it's like, here's his birth, you know, and then there's a flight into Egypt, and then they come back, set up shop in Galilee, and now, boom, let's jump ahead. You know, at least in Gospel of Matthew, which you're correct, that's where we are. So all of a sudden, let's jump ahead to John the Baptist, and Jesus is, you know, 30 years old or whatever. What Matthew seems like really concerned about doing is really just setting the table for Jesus being, one, the Son of God, not just like a Son of God, like you or I are, like children of God, or even as the children of Israel were, like the children of God, but like the Son of God, and Israel reduced down to one person. Like that's what Matthew tries to set up. And but it is, I think that also there is these mirrors that they talk about, these two deliverers, one obviously imperfect deliverance, and a deliverance from the physical slavery of Egypt, and then an ultimate deliverer from sin and death, which is Christ. But the information it gives you about their birth and their childhood is very similar.
Yeah, and on the road to Emmaus, when Jesus was talking with his disciples and, of course, opened their minds to understand the scriptures, it says, beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things concerning himself and all the scriptures. And, of course, Moses is often a shorthand for for the five books that Moses wrote, for what we call the Pentateuch. But I can't help but wonder also as if when Jesus began with Moses and with all the prophets, he also included plenty about Moses himself. Because they're often called types, these foreshadowings of the work of the Messiah. There's tons of them, of course, throughout the Old Testament. Jesus himself talks about how, of all people, Jonah was a type of him. Just as Jonah was 3 days in the belly of the fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days in the belly of the earth. But Moses is also referred to in the New Testament as a foreshadowing of the Messiah, and perhaps as is David and a lot of others. But Moses, perhaps more than any other, because he was so central to the central act of salvation for Israel. The Exodus, as we talked about a couple of episodes ago, it was the act of deliverance for the people of Israel. I mean, that was the defining moment for Israel. You know, just like we might say as Christians, you know, the central act of salvation for us, of course, is Christ crucified and risen. So in the language of the Old Testament, they would have said the central act of salvation is God's deliverance for God's deliverance of us out of Egypt. I mean, that was basically their creed. What God do you believe in, O Israel? Oh, well, we believe in the God who brought us up from the land of Egypt. That was it. That said everything about who they were and about who God was and how he had acted to save them. So this central act of salvation has Moses as a central character, and because of that, Moses becomes emblematic of the work in Messiah, both in who he is, kind of his own life story, if you will, as well as what he does for Israel. And on top of that, his role as a prophet. We have a direct messianic prophecy at the end of the book of Deuteronomy about God will raise up another prophet like Moses. And of course, that is the anointed one. That is the Christ, this prophet who's like Moses but greater than Moses.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's get back to Moses. So we are jumping ahead. I said 40 years old. That is actually not in Exodus. But if someone is interested, take a look at Acts chapter 7 sometime and read through that, because this is the this is the sermon that Stephen delivers right before he's killed, before he's the first martyr. And in that sermon, Stephen talks a lot about Exodus and Moses, and he actually adds some details which were probably kind of traditional fill-in-the-blank kind of stuff that was circulating among the Israelites. It's not necessarily in the Old Testament, but it was kind of part of the story of Moses. And one of those details that Stephen adds is that Moses was about 40 years old when what we're about to talk about took place. So what we're going to see here is actually three different episodes in the life of Moses that kind of give us a view of what kind of guy he was, what made him tick, and what, you know, really got under his skin, what made him react in to people and in situations. And if there's anything that kind of comes out of these stories, it is that Moses cannot stand injustice. That if there's anything that sets him off, that's what it is. We're going to see that in some situations coming up here. So the first of these gets Moses in big trouble. So he's grown up. Like I said, he's about 40 years old. And it says, this is interesting, he went out to see his brothers. So you got to think about this. He was born a Hebrew, of course. He is a Hebrew, but he was adopted at an early age by the Egyptians. He was raised in the palace of Pharaoh, where we're told, this is again from Acts chapter 7, that he was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. That's Acts chapter 7, verse 22. Now, again, we're not told that in the Old Testament. That's something that Stephen says, but it makes sense. If you're going to be raised in Pharaoh's household, then you're going to be also raised according to their educational model of the day. You're going to learn the Egyptian language. You're going to learn probably all of the religion and magic and politics and history and everything else that was part of their education. So here's Moses, raised as a Hebrew, raised as an Egyptian. And yet it says he went out to see his brothers. So there is an awareness. We don't know how this was cultivated, but there is a deep awareness on the part of Moses that he is still really a stranger in Pharaoh's house. Yes, he was raised there. Yes, he was adopted there. But he is a Hebrew, and he will always be. He will always be a Hebrew. And so he goes out to see those who are his, not just, you know, his fellow citizens, but his brothers. And it says he looked on their hard labors. So there's already beginning kind of here this, he has this familial connection with them. They're really his own flesh and blood. And he sees their hard labors. And so you can already begin to see here he has an awareness of what they're going through. But then we kind of come to the culminating act. He sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And it adds once more, one of his brethren. So twice it says he goes out to see his brothers, and then he sees an Egyptian beating one of his brothers. So Moses has a choice to make. And this is perhaps the most critical, this is the crossroads for Moses. This is the critical moment. This will really determine what his future is going to be. He doesn't know it, but we know it. What's he going to do? Is he going to try and stop him? Is he just going to turn around and go back to the palace? What will his action be? Well, it says he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So Moses has created a situation here for himself.
That is murder, by the way.
Just to clarify, I mean, if anyone's wondering, this is murder.
I mean, it's not. I mean, some might say like, oh, like he like stopped the fight. He didn't just like break something up, or I mean, like, he murdered this guy.
Yeah, he took him out. Think about this with me. I find this very interesting. Again, I'm gonna let me find it here so that I can read it. Because so, what was going on in the mind of Moses? That's a question I asked myself about this. Let's see here. I'm looking at Acts chapter 7. And this is, okay, so this is the way that Stephen is talking about this. It says, when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind, that is the mind of Moses, to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And this is the verse, this is the section that I think is most interesting. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him. But they didn't understand. Now, what do you think about Stephen's take on that? Well, he's kind of getting into the mind of Moses, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's sort of this, look, like going to the cause of the oppressed is like a good thing. We know, mm-hmm. we know that that's something that God would approve of and have you do. But like we do, we don't do it perfectly.
You kind know? Of overzealous action here, perhaps.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you take, you know, Jesus says, like, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, right? And the reason that you've heard it said an eye for an eye is because it was said an eye for an eye. I mean, that's like a real thing. But that doesn't mean that like you're beating me so I get to kill you. That's not an eye for an eye. An eye for an eye is a rule in place that Jesus even says that you don't have to follow and you shouldn't. Like, yeah, you don't have to take this. But the reason it's there is it's a buffer that says like, look, man, if somebody punches you in the face, you can't cut off their head. That's not an eye for an eye. So if somebody steals something from you, you can't just like take everything they own. Like you go, it's eye for an eye, hand for a hand, this kind of stuff, right? Like the punishment has to fit the crime, as it were.
That would be equity, right?
Right, right. And Jesus even says that like, but and you don't have to demand that even. But that is there not to say like you must take their eye if they take your eye. It's that you can't take more than their eye if they take your eye. Moses doesn't exactly roll this way. It's like you're beating this person, which obviously is terrible. Like, I'm gonna kill you. So it's the right motivation in the sense of like Mike, this is an oppressor who needs to be stopped. But of course, like we always do, like we go further than we ought, and decide that, well, I'm just going to end you.
Yeah, this might be what we would call today a crime of passion.
Right.
He's filled full of rage at seeing one of his brothers treated this way, and I mean, I don't want to psychoanalyze too much here, but you know, it could be that there's a little bit of guilt going on here on Moses' part because he's had it good all these years. And he is more than ready to do something to help his brothers. And so in his anger and in his haste and in his overzealousness, he ends up killing the Egyptian. He didn't just stop the fight. He didn't, I'm certain with his authority, he could have commanded the Egyptian to stop. He was, after all, royalty. But instead he basically goes too far. And he commits murder.
Well, and he knows it too. You know he knows it, because if this was no big deal, like, hey man, I got the authority to do this. This is fine. Like, this is what you get. You don't have to hide the body in the sand.
And notice he looks this way and that before he does it too. There's every indication in the text that Moses is like, he's scoping things out. I don't see anybody there. No, look, all clear. Bam. And yeah. Then he hides the body. So he's got guilt written all over him. Whatever his motivation, all his motivations might have been, he realized that if he did this, it was wrong, and if he was found out, then he was in big trouble. which, as we're about to hear, was exactly what happened. So this all happened one day. Then it says he went out the next day. So I mean, this is the very next day. The body is still in the sand, and he sees another fight, except this time it's not an Egyptian beating up on a Hebrew. It's two Hebrews that are beating up on each other. They're fighting. They're quarreling with each other. And one of them was hitting the other one. So Moses steps between them, and he says, "Why are you striking your companion? I mean, why are you beating up on one of your own people? Why are you doing this?" And his question gets answered by another question. So the guy that was beating up on the other one turns to Moses and says, "Hey, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And then it says, then Moses was afraid and said, "Uh-oh, surely the matter has become known." So we don't have enough time to go into all of this. We're almost at the end of our 40 minutes, but there's a pretty fascinating dynamic that's at work here in these small situations that's going to blow up much later on. So just in these two little stories that we just looked at, you really have kind of writ small what's going to be writ large later on. You got Moses coming between one of his people and the Egyptians and killing one of the Egyptians and burying his body in the sand. So now he's put himself against the Egyptians by this act. He wanted to save one of his own people, but to do that, he put himself against the Egyptians. And then now we turn right around the very next day, and when he's trying to act as a peacemaker between two of his own people, when he's actually wanting to do good for his own people and break up the fight and reconcile them, instead of interpreting his actions as those which are prompted by love, they said, Are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptians?" So they interpret, they see Moses, in other words, as not out for their good, but out to get them. And what we see as the story develops is that the same dynamic continues to play out in the life of Moses. I mean, he's sent by God eventually to deliver his own people from the Egyptians, so he's against the Egyptians in that way. And it just so happens that the same verb that's used, Naka, means to strike or to smite, just like Moses nakawed the Egyptians. He struck the Egyptian. That's the same verb that's going to be used when God strikes down the Egyptians later on. So that's going to expand as the story goes on. But also this unwillingness of the Israelite people to accept Moses that you see in this little episode here continues to be a major theme throughout the rest of Exodus. In fact, just like they said, "Are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptians?" So when they get into the wilderness later on, the Israelites are going to say, "You know, are you, you brought us out into the wilderness to kill us." So they're always interpreting these loving acts of Moses that he does in faithfulness to God and for the love of his people. They're kind of turning all those around. They don't want to accept the gift. Instead, they rebel against it and kind of twist it around to where it means something else. So what we see here is kind of what's going to be played out as we work our way through the rest of the story. But the story does continue. We're going to have to leave Moses once more in a kind of a precarious situation. We left him in water last time. We're going to leave him now with a heart full of fear because he doesn't know what's going to happen if it's found out by more people that he's committed this act.
That's it. Yeah. Worried that gossip is spreading and if it gets back to the wrong people that he's going to be in trouble, and we're going to have to leave him there. Guys, if If you enjoy Christ Hold Fast, if you enjoy 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, if you enjoy any of the stuff we do, the events, the podcast, the articles, you could help us out. We really could use it. We are actually trying to bring some stuff together that that costs a little bit of money. And so we could use your help. You might assume this stuff is like super well funded because it looks so good, but it isn't. It just happens to be a whole lot of volunteer work from people that are talented. So if you would like to help us do some of the things that we want to do, you can go over to ChristHoldFast.org, go over to the support page, and you can contribute there. And that would go a long way to that end. So thank you to those who have done that, and thank you to those who would be willing to consider it. All right, Chad. We will pick this back up again next week.
Yeah, look forward to it. We'll see y'all then.